No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. I may not have a vote, but I do have a voice. And tonight we're here to talk to two very important people that are dealing with what seems to be the number one question in America. We have with us Ruth Bengayet. She's a historian and the recipient of Guggenheim Fulbright and other fellowships. She's an expert on fascism, authoritarianism, war propaganda, and Donald Trump. Doesn't that really say it all? She writes frequently for the media on those topics and has provided podcasts and on-camera political commentary for Sky News, Slate, Salon, Democracy Now!, and Al Jazeera. We also have with us Dr. Laura Brown. Dr. Brown serves as a professor and the director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, a distinguished writer and dedicated scholar. She has written op-eds and blogs for the New York Times, Washington Post, Politico, The Hill, U.S. News and World Report, The Philadelphia Inquirer, one of my favorite papers, and The Huffington Post. Welcome, ladies. Thanks to both of you for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Sure. Yeah, let me start with ask you both the same question. Should we prosecute this man? Should Donald Trump be prosecuted? As we go through the January 6th hearing, it seems that things get worse and worse and worse, and we find out more and more and more. Is it important that we prosecute him?
So this is Laura Brown, and yes, I would say that it is important that he be indicted. Whether he is convicted will be determined by a jury, but I think there is enough evidence to indict on different charges, and I think it's important that it be done.
And how about you, Ms. Bengayet? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, it's Bengayet, actually.
Bengayet.
I agree fully. It's extremely important to show that we are upholding the rule of law, and failure to prosecute contributes, will only make the corruption and the violence worse. And it, in history, when you don't prosecute, their personality cults and myths about their infallibility, et cetera, all continue.
So given what you just said, is what if he wins? What if he wins the cases? Aren't these, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the criminal charges would be because I'm not a lawyer. I mean, it boggles the mind when you look at the things he's done. But what if he's not found guilty of anything? Because, you know, these things are very hard to prove, aren't they? And actual criminal charges. And doesn't that make him more of a, doesn't that add to his mystique? Doesn't that make him a bigger figure?
There's that risk, of course. But I think it's we've had so much evidence of his complicity, his guilt in inciting violence, and I think that's a risk that we have to take. Because not doing anything about it, not prosecuting, is giving a pass to all of the Trump imitators who have basically, the Republican Party has basically institutionalized January 6th as its, you know, election subversion, which is lying and corruption, everybody agreeing to conspire to continue a lie, and the violence of January 6th, all of that needs to be addressed, and its head, I see January 6th as a leader cult rescue operation, and he was the primary beneficiary, he was the primary instigator, and so it's very important to take that risk.
And
I'll just add to that. I think that's exactly right, that what you are facing is what economists call moral hazard if you do not, in fact, indict, meaning that other people in the future will decide, I won't get prosecuted either, so therefore I should go ahead and do it. So you really are having to guard for the future by ensuring that the rule of law is upheld in this instance. But beyond that, I think it's important to remember that there are many individuals who have been indicted who have not been found guilty. We think of it more often in terms of, murder cases and even celebrity murder cases. We can go back to the OJ trial where he was never criminally found guilty of killing Nicole Simpson. But he then had many civil trials that came after, and his wrongdoing was essentially societally determined through his many financial obligations.
Well, you know, the big question for me is, does this move the country in the right direction? As far as a deterrent goes, I think that if Donald Trump knew that he could get prosecuted and sent to jail for all these things, he would have done them anyway. I don't see it as a potential deterrent. I think that, you know, politics in America has been, you know, dirty, for lack of a better word, unfortunately, for hundreds of years. You know, we had Andrew Jackson said his only regret when he left office was he didn't get to shoot Henry Clay, the Speaker of the House, or hang his vice president, John Calhoun. I don't see this as a deterrent. Do you really think it would be a deterrent to future presidents?
I do. I think it's, in fact, incredibly important. I mean, part of why we are where we are is likely because Richard Nixon was granted a pardon. I mean, he was not held criminally accountable for any of the crimes with respect to Watergate. And I do think that as somebody who studied scandal, that there is this problem where the more that individuals are perceived to get away with things, the more future politicians will have really transgressive designs. It's also the case, and I think it's important to remember, that this wouldn't be so wildly unprecedented. I mean, it's certainly unprecedented in terms of indicting a former president, but we have actually a case with some of the most important presidents in our history, Thomas Jefferson charged Aaron Burr, his former vice president, with treason. There was a treason trial in 1807, and it was found that there wasn't enough evidence and Burr was let off. But that trial itself was incredibly important and did set the standard for what we understand treason to be today.
But isn't it all – I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ruth. Go ahead, please.
No, I agree with that. The other thing is – and I want to be really clear and blunt here – that I was able to predict that I wrote an op-ed for CNN before Trump took office saying that he was going to govern with the authoritarian playbook. And he was unlike any president before, Republican or Democrat, because he had an autocratic model of leadership. He also had an incredible record of you know, association with criminal with criminality. And in fact, he was under investigation, just like Putin and Berlusconi in Italy. He was under investigation when he ran for office. And this kind of leader, and my book Strongmen, unfortunately for us, he's in it, and he has the same personality and the same methods as many of these other leaders. Different outcome today. We don't have, you know, fascist dictatorships, one-party states as commonly. But they have no respect for the rule of law, and for example, his business model was all about finding the gray zone between the legal and the illegal. And there's never been anyone in the White House with the scope of different kinds of criminality as Trump. So I'm saying all this because whether it's there's precedent or not is important, and it's very important what Lara said about Nixon. But we will see in the future, his whole presidency is a kind of state of exception because there's never been anyone like Trump in office.
Well, you don't have to convince me of any of that, believe me. But let me just ask you again, Dr. Brown, isn't it a matter of politics and not the law? For example, the example you bring up with Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, you could also look at the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, right, who was impeached on a minor, he violated the Tenure of Office Act by firing a postal employee, which is a pretty minor offense, but he was impeached on the basis of that. Doesn't this all come down to politics and really not law?
Well, no, actually. Impeachment is a political charge. It is a charge that is levied by the House of Representatives. There is a political trial that is then held in the Senate, and it was determined in every case of impeachment thus far for a president not to convict. But that is separate from a crime, and a crime is something that needs to be indicted and at least moved forward with prosecution because of what Ruth said. The rule of law is vitally important. If you start to make exceptions for those who are engaging in election activity, then really at what point does the democracy completely unspool? Because what we have here, and we should be clear about the kinds of charges that President Trump would likely face, it would be conspiracy to defraud the United States, and also the sort of willful obstruction of an official proceeding. And I think those two things are incredibly important. We know that many people in many states have in fact been found guilty of a felony for casting two ballots in an election. That is a much lesser crime than I think what we have seen really that is building around President Trump. We know that Fani Willis down in Georgia is looking at how the president actually pressured Secretary of State Raffensperger to find him over 11,000 votes. That's much different than just casting two ballots.
Isn't that a really important point, though, that the system held, that you had people like Raffensperger who were Republicans, who were Trump supporters, in fact, in many cases, and they stood up and did the right thing? You know, Mike Pence stood up and did the right thing. Raffensperger stood up and did the right thing. The guy in Pennsylvania, they all stood up and did the right thing because they thought that the country was more important than Trump. Unfortunately, he doesn't share that opinion. But didn't the system hold?
It held. It held in amazing ways, and we should add that the military refused to go along with, because they were trying to have schemes for martial law, et cetera. And so the institutions held, but what has happened is that January 6th sent the Republican Party into what I call emergency mode and hugely further radicalized the party. So all of the tendencies that were already already going on to protect Trump, for example, one of the reasons he wasn't impeached the second time is he had put the GOP under a kind of authoritarian-style discipline, so you weren't allowed to have any internal dissent. And people, Republicans who voted in February 2021 to impeach him had to buy body armor because they were threatened. And then this then became, look what happened to Mike Pence, who Trump thought it was okay to hang him. This is the stuff of political thrillers. And a third of my book's on coups. So unfortunately, everything that happened and all the things we're learning about the Secret Service, all this is very typical in coup behavior. But it's very, very important to have that frame in order to understand that as soon as January 6th happened, they've been methodically going after that system. It's called autocratic capture. When you go after election judges, election workers, and you try and take control of the system, and they studied very carefully what didn't work last time for them. All the loopholes, all the people, the areas that didn't do what they needed them to do. And they're taking steps, as we know, to make sure that never happens again. So the system next time wouldn't hold as easily.
Yeah, that is a very scary thing, and that's exactly what they're doing. Let me ask you, Ruth, since you're an authority on fascism, authoritarianism, propaganda, do we have an environment? Because I care about what this does to the nation. Did we provide an environment for Trump to succeed? I mean, is America, are we all responsible for getting this man elected because there's an environment in the country now that allows this to happen?
That's such an interesting question. And, when there's support for these strongman-like figures, it's like a meeting of personality and circumstance. And Trump is a superb propagandist and marketer, and he, as we know, he wanted to run for president before, and he saw that the time was right in 2016. And what my research for my book shows is that the time that these kinds of people appeal is when a society's gone through a lot of change, could be workers' rights, could be gender equity, racial emancipation, that leave a lot of people feeling their status is threatened. And we had just gone through that with Barack Obama, legalized same-sex marriage, women admitted to combat, all the things we know. And Trump realized there was this moment that he could exploit. And what he did, and I was interviewed twice by the January 6th committee about this and other things, he systematically cultivated extremists, malcontents, he used emotional language, and he created this big tent environment so that all the different kinds of extremists and racists could feel valued by him. Unfortunately, that's what the fascists did too. When you have this charismatic leader and you have this certain kind of moment in history, and there's like an alchemy that happens and a movement is born, and there were, of course, the Tea Party, there were things that prepared the Republican Party and Republicans in general for this, but you need to have that spark of the charismatic leader who knows how to coalesce everybody and give it a focus. That's why the leader is so important, and it's been very important in the January 6th hearings.
Senator, let me maybe just jump in here too and try to answer your question from a process side, because I'm a political scientist. I've written a book about presidential elections and presidential candidates from 1796 through 2008. And then I just wrote a book about presidential leadership and how our visions of what we believe presidents should be has changed. And I will tell you that the one thing that I think is really important is that John Aldrich, who is a professor at Duke, he has a quote that I love that I think is so important. He says, "Yes, it's true that anyone can grow up to be president of the United States, so long as they grow up to be one of the two major political parties' nominees." And that is really about how did Trump get there? It's so important to realize that Trump got there because in 2016, there was a very large field. Many Republicans wanted to join in. He put his hat in the ring. He very quickly, because of his celebrity, became the best known of the field. And then with that sort of higher poll standing in the sort of low 30s among Republicans, he was able to dominate primary elections. And those primary elections on the Republican side at the time were mostly winner-take-all affairs. So what that meant was he very quickly became the front runner and the leading candidate with the most delegates, also because the process on the Republican side pushed him toward the nomination much faster than, say, had he run as a Democrat. In fact, there's been an analysis and political science that shows that had Trump actually run as a Democrat, he probably would have lost because Democrats use proportional representation. And had Hillary Clinton run as a Republican because they use winner-take-all, she would have had no problem wrapping up her nomination against Bernie Sanders. So some of this, too, is also process-induced. I don't deny at all what Ruth is saying about our culture and what we were looking for and the moment that his candidacy was right. But we also have to understand how structures help to create outcomes in politics.
Yeah, let me just make one comment about what Ruth said. I don't know why you get this, Ruth, and the Democratic Party doesn't. I mean, for years, I've felt, you know, as a Democrat, that we really don't understand how change has affected so many people in this country, has affected their attitudes. And I think we just take it for granted, especially living in Washington, D.C., that everybody thinks the same way that that we think. My big question, I guess, is if we prosecute him, won't he be able to put this off indefinitely? I mean, he's, you know, suing. This is what this man likes to do. He's got a ton of lawyers, right? So he's going to delay and drag his feet and appeal. Look, we just see Steve Bannon, who was just convicted on two very minor charges, which hold 30-day sentence in jail and a small fine, and he's appealing. And the reason I think he's appealing is because he wants to keep it going. And won't Trump just be out there for years delaying this and dragging his feet and appealing it? And doesn't that keep him on the front page?
Well, he's on the front page anyway, and it doesn't take away the moral obligation and political urgency of pursuing a prosecution. Because this is he's done this. His father, Fred, taught him to do this. This is their business model.
Yeah.
He and Berlusconi and Erdogan in Turkey are mass suers. They have been they have been in thousands and thousands of lawsuits, and they have their own Wikipedia page. Their legal issues, they're so copious. So I think it's not a reason not to do it. It's just foregone conclusion he's going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I almost felt sorry for the guy. 40 lawsuits, and he didn't win one. He just, what about the idea of prosecuting all the people around him that facilitated him? The Sidney Powells and the Steve Bannons and the, you know, Rudolph Giuliani's. Doesn't that really send the same message, since in a democracy, no one person can do what Trump tried to do? You need complicity. Don't you think that that would send the same kind of message? And I'd like both of you to respond to that.
Well, I mean, I think if you're talking about all of his sort of underlings who helped further this conspiracy from, you know, John Eastman to Rudy Giuliani to potentially Steve Bannon and Roger Stone, certainly. But I think they are just going to be part of the process. In other words, they would probably have to be prosecuted before the Justice Department was going to actually look to indict Trump, because what they would want to do is do what they do in most of these kinds of cases, which is make sure that those who aided and abetted in the crime, all of that knowledge is known, and potentially those individuals are able to flip. And so you're right that this could take a very long time. But I think that even when we look at Watergate, we know that it was almost, you know, 2 years before even some of the top aides were indicted. It is the reality of the justice system, but it doesn't mean that it shouldn't happen.
Yeah, that's very useful, what Laura said, to remind us that it was 2 years. And not only we're in, like, you know, insta mode, the way our brains work, the social media, we don't have as much, you know, patience, but it's also, that's how democratic justice works. And there's a reason that Trump, you know, met with the Chinese head of state and said, oh, I admire you. You can just, like, execute someone whenever you want. You know, they don't have to do any of this. We would never be having hearings in most, many states around the world. They would never be possible, these hearings. So, and about, you know, you have to, the enablers are very important, but in a system dominated by somebody with a strong personality cult, all those people had a place in the conspiracy. Their place in the conspiracy only made sense because of Trump. And the big lie was an entirely self-serving propaganda. It's going to be looked upon as one of the most successful propaganda campaigns in history. And it benefited primarily who? Trump. Because he leaders like him cannot leave office because they're afraid of not being adored anymore. They're afraid of losing immunity from prosecution, all kinds of things. And they never, ever go quietly. And the big lie allowed him to keep grifting from people, you know, with his non-existent election defense fund. It also allowed his personality cult to remain intact, which is very important for his followers, because it allowed them not to have to reckon with the fact he was a loser. And personality cults are extremely psychologically powerful. And so it did a lot of things, a big lie, but it was all about him. So it would make no sense to, you have to prosecute those around him, but you also have to prosecute the head. It's like when you go after you know, terrorists or something, you have to get at the head of the cell. This is the same principle. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense, and the danger remains.
Well, let's talk about his cell for a minute. And that is that, you know, you have these Trump people. I've got to tell you, my mother was a Republican committee woman, and she wouldn't have voted. As soon as he said what he said to Billy Bush about what he does to women, my mother wouldn't have voted for him if God came down and told her to vote for him. But there's plenty of people that just dismiss all his bad behavior. And that, you know, he has this core group, right, of fanatics who will believe him when he says this is just another witch hunt. You know, Democrats have been after me since the day I came into office, which is true, actually. But we had good reason to be after him. And so there's two things that I think are going on here. And I wonder what you think about him. First of all, I think if he goes for the nomination, what the January 6th committee has done is they've effectively emboldened other Republicans to run against him. And if he goes for the nomination, don't you think that'll tear the Republican Party apart at this point? I mean, won't the Trump people and the people that are trying to secede Trump just tear each other apart?
Well, unfortunately, that was how Trump was nominated the first time. is that there were so many people who jumped in to the Republican nomination, and each one of them believed that if they could just get to where it was them and Trump, they could best Trump. Ted Cruz was the one who came the closest, but you could see that he was far behind by the time that winnowing process happened. Yeah. So, in fact, a nomination structure where there are a lot of candidates who actually are going after Trump may, in fact, help him to survive.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true. Ted Cruz had his moment in the sun in Iowa, and that was about it. But and that's the worry I have that because even as a Democrat, look, I've been a Democrat my whole life. I bleed Democratic blue. I was a Teamster. I was born to be a Democrat. But I understand that we need a healthy Republican Party in America, as well as a healthy Democratic Party. So that worries me a little bit. And let me say, before we go any further, that recent polls show that 60% of America agrees with both of you ladies. They believe that he should be prosecuted. What do you think? How important do you think that is, that you have a majority of the population that stands with you on this issue, that he should be prosecuted?
I think it's very important. That doesn't matter at all to the Republicans, because as we know, many of their policies are way out of whack with what Americans' desires are, and they don't care. I wanted to address the previous thing for a second. One of the issues you see with somebody like Trump, who's so dominating, and actually gives one of the main things he did, which was very liberating to many Republicans, he gave people permission to be lawless. He allowed them to go where they had never thought they could go before, to drop their professional ethics, to not have to behave according to inconvenient norms of professionalism and ethics. All of that went out the window, and you were rewarded for that. And if you look at, and so the system spawns these, it not only changes people and makes them their worst selves, and that's what Trump wants. Everybody has to be their worst self around him, like Bill Barr and all these other enablers. But it spawns imitators, and I'm very worried about Ron DeSantis. I've written about 5 op-eds about him already, because he has absorbed the lessons of Trump. And he's also a case study of how, in order to get ahead with the Republican Party, you have to now embrace, the lying, the corruption. And so here's somebody who used to be a Reagan conservative, and on, November 2020 was very proud that Florida didn't have any fraud. And now he's got this, Big Brother kind of office of, quote, election security. And has become a very far-right extremist figure. So the whole party, when you say the country needs a healthy Republican Party in a bipartisan system, yes, it does, but the Republican Party has become, I really see it as, it is in the middle of a transformation into an extremist entity, which is very scary. And the kinds of behaviors and morals that are rewarded now are have nothing to do with conservatism.
I'll just add to that. I think Ruth is completely right that the Republican Party has lost its way because it has so often bowed to former President Trump. And I think we can even see this lawlessness that Ruth mentions in something that is somewhat minor, but not really. Look, I served in President Clinton's administration, and I remember when I was an appointee, it was absolutely prohibited to do anything that was slightly political while you were in your appointment, right? That was a violation of what's called the Hatch Act.
The Hatch Act, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Hatch Act became regularly violated, so much so that we had the Republican you know, convention essentially in the White House. I mean, there was such a return to this idea of parties running the official government, which really we had left behind in the 1800s with all of the original progressive reforms that erected the civil service.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it amazed me. I was invited to the Republican convention. I've been to the past 11 nominating conventions of the Democratic Party, but I was invited to the Republican convention and in Cleveland, the first one, and it was amazing that the governor wouldn't come out and tell people they couldn't carry guns, and they all showed up with guns, and the police were hysterical. You know, the last thing they wanted was all these, you know, kind of bubbas walking around in the crowd with guns on. You know, it made security. I've never seen so many cops in all my life, and they were all on edge about this. And you know, it doesn't seem like anybody has the guts to stand up to this guy. But you know, that's an old saying in politics that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. Let me ask you a question. Now, I don't know how much of a, you know, what impact this can have. But under the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment says no person shall be a senator or representative of Congress or elector or president or vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or an executive, blah, 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 to support the Constitution of the United States shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid and comfort to enemies thereof, but Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such persons. Can we keep him from running again, you think? Can Congress do something? Can we impeach him in absentia or under the 14th Amendment if he's convicted of insurrection? Can we keep him from running again?
Well, certainly, I am not a sort of congressional legal expert at this level, but what is true is that you know, Congress can create some sort of censure resolution and engage in that. I mean, there is no reason why that couldn't be done. That was one of the things that was discussed about the original, his second impeachment hearing that was related to his incitement of the rioters on January 6th. So I don't see any reason why they couldn't prevent him from running again. But I think it's also true that what is more important than what Congress does is going to be what the Republican Party chooses to do and how they look to embrace him or not. And at the moment, it appears as though the Republican Party has said that they would be essentially neutral in this process. And that may pose problems for the future.
Well, don't you think? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ruth. Go ahead.
Oh, I also don't have the expertise, but it's a very, Senator, you raise a really interesting question. But what, as somebody who looks at extremism, what I am, one of the things I'm very worried about is how many GOP sitting lawmakers are talking so often about the right to insurrection. In fact, the whole discourse Matt Gaetz and all of these people make about guns is, it has to be mimicked if you want to have a future in the Republican Party. So, you know, Dr. Oz did it too, that, you know, the Second Amendment is not about hunting, recreation. It's about the right to rebel, to have an insurrection against a tyrannical government. And this is one of the party lines now. And so they're actually, not only they in the general, they don't care about being tagged as insurrectionists. They're actually constantly talking about the right to insurrection. that doesn't change the 14th Amendment, but it's a cultural, political, the political culture of the Republicans has shifted so radically that all of a sudden that's an okay thing to say, and they all say it.
Well, you know, that to me is the more important point here, what you just made, that, it, you know, it's how it's what the culture and what the parties, you know, how they're going to proceed. And yeah, it's just amazing to me that they can do that, given that the first four words of the Second Amendment are a well-regulated militia. But, you know, they think instead of supporting the government, that, you know, which was the idea of the Second Amendment, it's to protect themselves from the government. It's just amazing. But what can we do?
Well,
you know,
Senator, can I just jump in with one other thing
please.
That I think is important, especially because most Democrats are loath to admit this. But one of the reasons why our system held is actually because of the complicated nature of the Electoral College. I know the Democrats don't like that, but they do and should ask themselves what would have happened if there was a national popular vote where all votes were aggregated and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo got to determine whether or not that vote was valid. I think it's important to recognize that the framers, and in Federalist 68, Alexander Hamilton argues that nothing was more to be desired than that they essentially create every obstacle that was practical that would oppose, quote, cabal, intrigue, and corruption. So one of the things that actually helped in this situation is that it is very difficult to rig a presidential election. You have to engage multiple states. You've got to get fake electors. You've got to do all sorts of things and involve a whole bunch of people. And by the very fact that you're doing that, you're actually creating a conspiracy that is almost inevitably going to be found out. And that's where we are today. So I do think, as many problems as the Electoral College have, we should acknowledge that it was part of having to rely on election officials in Arizona and in Georgia and in Pennsylvania and in Wisconsin that actually protected the overall vote on Election Day.
Well, I think that's a very important point. And, you know, the idea that we get rid of the Electoral College is certainly, in my humble opinion, a knee-jerk reaction. You know, it just seems more democratic to get rid of it. But I think you're absolutely right. And so I asked you, right when the election was over, I was asked to speak to a bunch of people, and I had a woman stand up in the audience and say, as liberal Democrats, we have nothing to apologize for. And I said, of course we do. This man got elected because we, you know, if we had put up a candidate and supported her and done what we were supposed to do, he wouldn't have gotten elected. So what can, if that's true, what can we do as Democrats, do you think? What can we do as Democrats?
I think the most important thing that Democrats should focus on is they need to take a look at the rules and the procedures. And I do think that Democrats fail to notice how many places in the system they have to either overcome with strategy or with dedicated activity. And I tend to think that when I look back, so much is this idea of, well, the majority believes it. Well, even if that's true, even if the majority believes it, and even if 48% of the people voted for Hillary Clinton, that didn't necessarily mean that she was going to win. And this is where looking at how the procedures work, I just think is so vitally important, because popularity isn't the whole story.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. I was a staffer at the DNC for many years, and we started to do a half-hearted effort when I was there to look at some of these things, and we never followed through on it where the Republicans have always been good at it. And they're, you know, as you've already pointed out, they're already working on it today. They're working at ways to put in their own electors and do other ridiculous things like that. So, Ruth, again, what do you think we could do? What can we do as Democrats? Is there anything we can do about the environment that we're in right now? Because that's what really bothers me, is that this is somehow going to be more divisive for the country.
I think it's really important to reach out to undecided voters, to non-voters, to even Republicans in your family, in your circles, and try and kind of build bridges and talk to them. And again, go back to the poll you cited that, you know, 60% of Americans believe that, you know, there's grounds for prosecuting Trump. And also, I think it's really important, I've started giving talks to business associations, that to let people know, and this is an unfortunate, you know, knowledge I have of how authoritarian governments kind of ruin society. There's this myth that it's good for business, it's stable, it's law and order, and it's quite the opposite. And just as gun violence costs, you know, over $200 billion a year, that's not good for anybody. So talk about outcomes. Civil strife and this low-level and violence and threat that so many have, like right now, I publish a political newsletter called Lucid, and my latest one is about how librarians are being attacked. You know, they're getting at the kind of fabric of civil society, teachers, librarians. And none of this is good for business. It's not good for social fabric. And I think we need to educate others and try and get them to vote. I'm always shocked by how many people didn't vote in the last elections.
Yeah.
And if you were ever, this is do or die. And it's hard to mobilize people because they take democracy for granted. And even yep. though rights are being rolled back and it's going on in front of everyone's eyes, I think many people don't follow politics, and they think it's not going to affect them. So that's something that I think it's very important to do, is mobilize as many voters and get new people to vote.
And let me just also say and emphasize what Ruth is saying, because I think something is so important here that gets lost. Policy debates between Republicans and Democrats, that happens within inside a Democratic system. What we are actually facing right now is a Republican authoritarian wing that is interested in changing the nature of the system entirely. And that is very different. We have actually in the United States never had that. When you think about our Civil War, when you think about the nullification crisis, when you think about other moments, even Aaron Burr being charged with treason, all of those were about separatist movements. They were all about people trying to leave the Union. What is so wild about the moment we are in is that there is actually a group of individuals who would like to overthrow the Union and the government and install a different government. That is quite different, and it has nothing to do with what we have always known as sort of Republican versus Democratic debate.
That's so important. And in fact, when the watershed was the 2016 election, which I watched in horror given my background, because Hillary Clinton became a political enemy. And what do you do if you're authoritarian with your opponent, with your political enemy? You lock them up. This was new. So that the whole culture of Republican, in fact, that's why they're not doing debates anymore. Because they don't want to debate. That's the whole political culture is being shifted in ways that prepare for some kind of autocratic rule. and differences of opinion, even within the party. I keep stressing that's very important, that within the party there can't be any debate either. That's authoritarian.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when we see this in other places in the world, too, we see this in India, for example, the world's largest democracy, with this guy Modi, who's not very different from Trump, or in Brazil with that nut, or Venezuela. We see these movements happening all over the world. And again, I think, you know, Ruth, I could spend a whole hour just talking to you about environment. But we're starting to run out of time here, so let me do a couple of important things. I want you both to tell people how they can reach out, how they can get your books, how they can reach you online, how they can see what you have to say. Ruth, do you want to go first? Do you have a website?
Sure. My website is www.ruthbengiat.com. And I'm also on Twitter, there in my bio, you can find a link to subscribe to my newsletter called Lucid, which is free to subscribe. And I write all about these things, U.S. and global. And those are probably the best ways to find my work.
And you, Dr. Brown?
So you can find me via my personal website, which is just Lara, L-A-R-A, M. Brown, PhD.com. And you can also find me on Twitter and on LinkedIn. I'm happy to engage in conversation and talk about the importance of this moment for our republic.
Yeah, you know, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you both being on the show, because I think this is so important. And I think that we are in a place that we've never been before. And it's scary. And when you talk about voter participation, you know, in the nation's capital, where politics is really our business, less than 50% of the people vote. So it's ridiculous. What do you ladies, just quickly, think about paying people to vote? They do it in Australia, and they have like 90-some percent of participation.
So I'll just jump in and say that actually I think the right not to vote is important in our democracy as well. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I would encourage it or that I believe in it, but I think that there is something uniquely Americanly, sort of American and democratic about the choice to disengage. I also would say that one of the things that I think people don't realize, they tend to believe that if there's a larger turnout, it favors Democrats. That's not necessarily true. The larger the turnout, the sort of more unpredictable the election. So the reason why people should vote is because I think our election should be, to a certain extent, unpredictable. But it is a civic duty, and I think it's something important, but I am not in favor of requiring it by any means.
Well said.
I think Laura's answer was great, so I don't have anything to add. I agree with all of that.
Okay. We're almost out of time here, ladies. Is there anything you want to add? Is there something that I didn't ask you that you think is important to add?
Oh, I think the district should have two senators.
Oh, yeah.
State.
Yeah.
Agree.
Oh, okay. So that's wonderful, and I love you for saying that. And by the way, Ms. Bengat, my wife's a librarian, so she's going to love you for pointing out that librarians are under attack these days as well. Thank you, ladies, for being on the show. I really appreciate this. I think this is so important to our democracy. You know, there's a Chinese curse, which is may you live in interesting times. And I think that we're finding out that we're in interesting times. So thank you so much for being on the show. Folks, we'll see you next week. We always leave with a song. Here's one from Warren Zevon, Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Thanks so much.
Give the people their right to vote. 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 Give the people their right to vote.